accession number 18707, Reel 3.
Geoffrey Poole, Reel 2.
I'll try and answer your question.
Yes, can you tell me a bit about your work on the Trident and your memories of it?
Well, the Trident really began with as one of the projects that was going into our aerodynamics department for all the treatments concerning aerodynamics. The structures department essentially deals with ensuring that the airframe is adequate for its job. The design department puts it all together. The aerodynamics department is a sort of a handmaiden to a number of subjects, which include aeroelastics and weight and balance and fluid flow, drag and control, all these things, stability. There's a man, I suddenly recall, John Wimpany. He was very much involved in the stability of all the aeroplanes that we had to deal with, and he's a man that I think it would be beneficial if you could talk to, but I'm going off the point a little bit.
I wanted to go on to
Trident. The Trident sequence.
Yes.
It began with the sort of three-engine configuration for 100 passengers for BEA, the thing that became the Trident 1. There was the 1C, which was an adaptation to improve the range, and the 1E, which took it even further with slightly better engines. This was all in the early 60s. Eventually, we found a formula which was attractive to had worldwide possibilities, the 2E. And I think the Trident 2E was something like a middle 60s. Can't remember all the dates now, but that was the way in which the aeroplane developed. It was all essentially around the work that Phil Smith did as chief designer. Phil Smith has died, as you perhaps know, but he was the man. We've seen his picture on the video somewhere, but he was the man who was noted by Sir Geoffrey to have particular capabilities in the business of civil airliner design on a large scale, and during the 60s he was a very important person. He was chief designer of the whole series of Trident aircraft, which were designed, built and operated, and initially flown from and subsequently operated by either BOAC or BEA or other countries worldwide, as we sold the aeroplane to a number of customers abroad, particularly in the Middle East, Far East.
Now, the Trident had a T-tail, didn't it?
Yes.
And that, it ran into the steep stall problem at one time, didn't it?
There was the limitations of the tail became evident. I'm afraid Braxton Brown and one or two others, I can't remember all their names now, over Norfolk.
George Arrington.
Yes. They had to demonstrate the fact that you couldn't put the aeroplane into a super stall, and the unfortunate fact was they could. And so the design was adjusted, and there were limitations placed on the operation of the aeroplane so that it couldn't happen again. But
in other words, the nose came up, and the engines were starved of air, so you couldn't put power on to get out of it.
That is true, because the engine's intakes were behind the wing. They were affected by the flow off the wing. But the aeroplane in the super-stalled condition, it was just uncontrollable. It got an aerodynamic state whereby it just sank at quite a large sinking speed, of course, but not a very disastrous thing from an air point of view, but it was just not controllable. I can remember this occurring. I wasn't very much involved in this aspect of the aeroplane at that time, but this is, for example, a thing which Don Dykins could give you a much better dissertation on, because he was chief aerodynamicist at that time, perhaps just subsequently, but he still will have a very particular knowledge of this particular aspect of the aeroplane. It was a disaster, but...
They have a stick pusher or something put in at the end, do they?
Well, if you have a device which tells you that the situation is coming on, the pilot gets a reaction which he can respond to. It's a situation which you can avoid, but if you don't know that it's coming, it can put you in a situation which is irretrievable. But more than anything else, you need a man who is familiar with the aerodynamics of the aeroplane in this particular respect. I can't do justice to your question, really.
Do you remember the time when Boeing were invited in to look over the shop?
We had various contacts with Boeing from time to time, but I didn't remember that particular one. No.
There was a story going around that Lord Douglas of Kirkleside had insisted that Boeing, who were producing the 727, had the run of the shop, so that they could see any problems coming.
Well, the 727 was a very similar aeroplane, except that it was just slightly bigger.
Yes. But you don't remember Boeing designers coming into your office?
No. But I did have occasion to go to America on a number of occasions, but not on that particular subject.
No. Did you go to Boeing's?
Yeah. I've been to Seattle, but I haven't been to Boeing's. The particular reasons for going to America was... The first instance, well, it was Canada, where we had a design exercise on the go with DH Canada. This was in 1966, I think. And that was very interesting when we were looking at the possibilities of collaboration. Other occasions have taken me to the Midwest. My memory's failing. There were conferences on which were set up to discuss particular subjects year by year, and on various occasions I went over there to attend them. And one was down in New Orleans. One was quite near to where John Ellis lived when he was at just south of Chicago. My time in America was mostly concerned with various disciplines on specific aircraft subjects. The most interesting one was in, as I said, just said, was in Canada. But that was looking for the possibility of collaboration. in mind?
Well, I mean, you met Sir Geoffrey de Havilland, presumably, on occasion.
Yes, yes, he was a very, very kind man. The tale that's been told more than once is the fact that if you met him in the corridor, he's just as likely to open the door for you, rather than have the door opened for him. But he was very thoughtful, very perceptive, I found him a very pleasant person. I didn't have a lot of contact with him, mark you, but with the little I did.
Did he know your name?
Possibly. In those days, my position in the company wasn't all that grand, so possibly not, but...
What about his son, Geoffrey?
Geoffrey, well, the contact I had with him was mostly concerned with flight loadings, because every time an aeroplane flew, including the time that he unfortunately crashed in the Thames estuary, there has to be a flight loading which enables the pilot to see what was the weight and balance of his aeroplane at the time he was flying it, so that he knows whether it's heavily loaded, lightly loaded, or there are specifications laid down for what these things should be, of course, but on any given flight, both the people on the ground and the people in the air need to know the state of flight of their aeroplane. That's one of the things that I got very much involved in.
He was a very conscientious pilot, was he?
Oh, yes. Very, very meticulous, in fact. But he was a very powerful person in many respects. And
Powerful physically, or...?
Yes. He was young Geoffrey.
Yeah, the young Geoffrey.
Yes, yes. Yes, he was. He had a splendid physique.
He's very tall, wasn't he?
Yes. But, I have talked to John Derry way back, a long time ago now. I have spoken to other pilots since. There are one or two on this list here who are still in the vicinity that I occasionally come in contact with.
How did you get him, like John Derry? Did you work with him much?
Not a lot, no, but there's an example of his manner on one of these videos. He was, I can't think of the best word to use, frankly, but...
Self-effacing?
Yes, he wasn't. He didn't impose himself on you. He's a very nice chap to know. The people who I had most contact with were in the design building, which I think you probably know is adjacent to the road from.
And who were they?
The people in the. Three basic departments that I have described to you. In the aerodynamics department, we had, years and years ago, Mr. Clarkson was chief engineer, and subsequently we had David Newman, who now lives down at Axminster, and after that there was Don Dykins, who still lives locally. Finally, when I left, there was Alan Young, who initially went up to Woodford when the 146 part of the organisation went up to Woodford. Because you perhaps know that up until I retired in 1988, and at that time, most of the chief functions at Hatfield were still thriving. There was the Airbus work in collaboration with Filton. There was the 125 in collaboration with the Americans, and the Airbus in collaboration with Airbus Industry, and they, when within a few years of my retirement, the situation changed radically. Because all the Airbus work either went down to Filton or across to France, and the 125 went off with Raytheon, and the um, 146 all went up to Woodford. And the place more or less was emptied, and now the design building is occupied by the some departments from the local university. So there's in within sort of 5 years of my.
Is the runway still open there?
No. The part of the runway is still there. Most of the buildings at the factory are now reoccupied by somebody else, either local authority, local university, post office, and of course the east side of the aerodrome is now a business park, and there is that's one of what used to be part of the organisation associated with Stevenage was quite close to Hatfield is the Matra Marconi unit at Stevenage, and they have got similar. Well, they've taken over all the developments that are associated with missiles and that sort of work. Anything to do with space and missiles.
It's all a matter of amalgamation these days into bigger and bigger units.
Well, they get reshuffled into people with like interest, so that all anything concerned with big airliners is now either Toulouse, Germany, or Filton, and that's the spread of those things. And a lot of people who I have known in the past have moved with their work, and so you find a number of people down at Airbus Industry, for example, have come from various elements in Hatfield, and the other way around, the 146 took a lot of people up to Woodford to reorganise the 146. You know there was a proposal for it to be a two-engined aeroplane.
No, I didn't.
Yes, the and was now Woodford call it the RJ, regional jet, and so that things have changed quite a lot in a very short time.
Can I take you right back to the beginning now? Because when you were an apprentice, a student, in the war years, in Hatfield and Salisbury Hall, places like that, you presumably were reserved occupation.
Probably, but...
you weren't in uniform or anything?
No. Well, I was in a particular difficulty in the fact that I damaged my left wrist and... And I spent part of 1 year in hospital.
So you probably wouldn't have been called up anyway.
No. I was unfortunately incapable, although many of the people I were with at that time did go in the services.
I mean, was there any comments passed in your direction as to why you aren't in the army or something by outsiders?
I never had that. I was, in fact, very much involved with the local Home Guard, but that's a very different kettle of fish. But,
how did you move around from site to site, on a bicycle?
At that time, we used to have a very small petrol allowance for going from place to place on a motorcycle. But motorcycles are very economical with petrol. This occasion when I had to go down to other side of Oxford.
Other side of Oxford?
Just gone out of my head. Whitney.
Whitney, yeah.
On that occasion I was provided with a small amount of petrol to go and do that job. That was the way in which travel was accomplished in days of petrol rationing.
Was there any more bombing on Hatfield apart from that one?
It in one sense it tended to follow me around because in 1940, as I told you earlier, there was a Junkers 88 that bombed the factory. There was another occasion much later when some bombs were dropped, but they didn't really have any significance. They just fell in open country, I think. But towards the end of the war, I was living on the west side of Hatfield, and a V2 bomb landed. It's described in the local book, which landed on Selwyn Estate, which is just to the west of Hatfield, near the Comet, in fact. And it demolished a house, which was 100 yards away, I suppose. My landlady lost all her ceilings, but. We didn't happen to be there at the time, so it was the situation was recoverable. Then on another occasion, the road just close to where we're sitting now, in Dimion Road, there was another bomb there. At that time, I was living in a guest house quite close, but I was far enough away not to be affected by it. So during the war, there were those three events. There was the factory and the houses to the west and the school towards the centre. Those were the times when Hatfield was literally in the front line.
What sort of hours did you work?
All the hours that God sent.
Really? Right up to midnight and beyond?
Well, we used to have not only times of work at the factory, mostly in assistance to some man to whom you were set to work with. There was... what do you say? Who did I work with? I've forgotten my train of thought, I'm afraid. Can you put your question again?
Yes, I was asking you how long hours you worked.
Oh, yes, well, in addition to the work that was done, manual work that was done in the various departments, in order to cover the theoretical side, there was quite a lot of schoolwork to be done, which was mostly done in the evenings. But one day a week, I used to go to Northampton Poly, which is quite close to, which at the time was in the, quite close to the Angel in Islington, and we had some. I had a. Effectively a college report from them on the work that I did on various aspects of aerodynamics at the time. But there was schoolwork done locally in classrooms and various places which were available for teaching, and mostly people with departmental responsibilities in the factory gave the lectures. For example, the The chief structural engineer came along and periodically gave classes on the business of the structural calculations. Ralph Hare was one of the people who I'm indebted to for the things I learned at that time from him. But aerodynamics was covered by various people from the aerodynamics department, and design the same. The fact was that aside from the practical work which you did at the factory, there was also the business of learning the theory and taking examinations to show that you had mastered the subject. This is the way in which the education of the people principally within the tech school was accomplished, and it was very effective. But it did take a lot of effort to keep up with the pace, because you very often find that having done most of a day's work and been to a lecture, you then got homework to do before the next lecture, and this made put time very much at a premium.
So you lived in lodgings when you were up there?
Yes.
Did you have a weekend off to go and see your parents or anything, or what was your routine?
Usually, you made an arrangement with your landlady as to whether or not you were going to want 5-day lodging or 7-day lodging, and I've had both. And when I was working on 5-day week, I would travel to see my parents at the weekend, or something like that. If you were on 7-day, you had the opportunity of finding your friends and accomplices in this area. And there were quite a few ways in which young people could attend clubs and establish contact with people of like interest.
When you say clubs, what kind of clubs were
there? Well, there was a youth club at Green Lanes, which is at the north end of the aerodrome. That is one that I used to go to on occasions, and that's in fact where I met my wife some 57 years ago.
Mm. What were you earning in those days?
When I first came to Hatfield, it was £2.76 a week. It grew. When I first had a job, it was in terms of hundreds a year. I don't think we got to the thousands for quite a long time. Mm. But
you didn't really have the time or the money to go into pubs and...
No. Pubs did have attention on occasions, but not particularly. But the way you can... I had a fairly responsible job to do in the early 50s, and I had enough money to buy my first house, and I got a mortgage, but the house was only just over £2,000 total. That's the difference between then and now.
Yeah.
Since then, I mean, I bought a house here, and 20 years later it was worth 10 times as much.
Yeah.
That's the difference in scale.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether I can... would you like to turn it off a moment? I'd like to take a coffee.